chapter 109. Jesus at the house of this terrible Pharisee. His name is Doris. And the death of Jonah. And it's on page 577. The scene here. It is a cloudy day in November in the plains of Esdraelon. Jesus is passing by. He sees men working in the fields with great exhaustion because they're forced to work like beasts. 11 of the disciples are with Jesus. Judas is absent. Peter goes in search for the fields that belong to the wicked Pharisee, Doris. He asks four thin, tired peasants if they are workmen for Doris. They say no, but work for his relative, Johanan. When they learn that the Messiah is near, they express the hope that they might see him. Peter calls the Messiah, and Jesus comes at once. The four men fall flat on their faces before him. Jesus blesses them. Peter urges them to get up. They tell Jesus that Jonah, that's the one they're trying to redeem, told them about the Messiah, and they were hoping Jesus would love them as he loves the shepherds who saw him at his birth. The four workers are afraid they'll be seen with Jesus and punished severely, so they begin to work out a schedule so that they can spend some time with Jesus. So Peter now offers to help them with their field work and the plowing. He invites several other disciples to join him, John, James, and Andrew, to help him with the work while the workers talk with Jesus. They're very grateful for this help, and Jesus shares his food with them and tells them that he's staying at Doris' place. But they warn Jesus about the cruelty of this man, and Jesus and the disciples now head for the farm. He inquires about Jonah from Doris' field hands. They tell him that poor Jonah, after 2 hours of work in the field, fell down totally exhausted, and there's little hope for his life. Jesus first goes to meet Doris, and he acts as if nothing had happened. And he said, if Doris sees that he is being met fairly and squarely, he may be pitiless towards Jonah and the servants. Well, Doris comes out of the house to meet Jesus. In appearance, I'm quoting this, he's an old man with a hard profile of a rapacious person. Ironic eyes, a serpent's mouth wriggling, a false smile in a beard more white than black. Jesus does not say peace to him, but says, may your salutation return to you. Doris parades his wealth before Jesus, showing him rare plants in his garden and orchard, and his servants bring delicious fruits on golden trays and cups. Jesus is indifferent to all this display. Doris prides himself on having the only kind of rare pear trees in Palestine, to which Jesus replies, and this is page 583, middle of the page. And Jesus says, but they are plants of God, and all men are equal. And Doris says, equal? No, I equal to your Galileans. Souls, Jesus says, come from God, and he creates them equal. But I am Doris, the faithful Pharisee. He looks as proud as a peacock in saying so. Jesus darts a glance at him with his sapphire eyes, which are becoming brighter and brighter, a sign that denotes oncoming pity or severity. Jesus is so much taller than Doris and towers over him, stately in his purple tunic near the small, slightly bent Pharisee, wrinkled in a garment strikingly wide and rich in fringes. Doris, after some time of self-admiration, exclaims, Jesus, why did you send Lazarus, the brother of a prostitute, to the house of Doris, the pure Pharisee? Is Lazarus your friend? You must not do that. Don't you know that he is anathematized because his sister Mary is a prostitute? And Jesus says, I know but Lazarus and his deeds which are honest. But the world remembers the sin of that house and sees that his stains spread to his friends. Don't go there. Why are you not a Pharisee? If you wish, I am influential. I will have you accepted, although you are a Galilean. I can do anything in the Sanhedrin. Annas is in my hands, that's the high priest, like the edge of my mantle. People would be more afraid of you. And to this then, while he's playing a game of deception, it all takes place in the orchard garden while they're waiting for mealtime. Doris haggles over the sale for Jonah. He asks Jesus in exchange for a favor, namely to bless his herds and fields. He says that the blessing Jesus bestowed on his farm last year made his farm famous for the rich harvest that was reaped. Jesus resists the invitation and asks, "Where is Jonah?" With a severe voice, Doris pretends that Jonah is in the fields and will come after the meal. Again, Jesus says, and we pick up the conversation on page 584. He repeats, "Where is Jonah?" in a loud, thundering voice. "I told you, where they are plowing. He is the first servant and does not work. He is the first servant and does not work. He is at the head of the men." "Liar," Jesus says. "Me? I swear to it by Jehovah." "Perjurer," Jesus says. "Me? I a perjurer? I am the most faithful believer. Watch how you speak." "Killer," Jesus says. His voice is rising louder all the time. And this last word is like a thunder. His disciples go near him, Jesus. Servants look out the door frightened. Jesus' face is unendurable in its severity. Phosphorescent rays seem to be emanating from his eyes. Doris is frightened for a moment. He shrinks, a bundle of fine clothes near the tall person of Jesus, clad in a dark red woolen tunic. Then his pride prevails, and he shouts with his squeaky voice like a fox's, "Only I give orders in my house. Get out, you vile Galilean. I will go out after cursing you. Your fields, herds, and vineyards for this year and the years to come." "No, don't." "Yes, it's true. Jonah is ill, but he's being taken care of. He's well looked after. Withdraw your curse." "Where is Jonah?" "Let a servant lead me to him at once. I paid for him. And since he is a piece of merchandise, a machine for you, I consider him as such. And since I purchased him, I want him." Doris now blows on a golden whistle three times, and the servants from the house in the fields come running in dread of what to expect. He orders them to bring Jonah to Jesus, but Jesus doesn't wait. He leaves without telling Doris where he's going. He follows the servants to the filthy hovel where Jonah, who is skin and bone, half naked due to a high temperature, breathing with much difficulty, is lying on a cane mat covered by an old worn-out blanket. And then Jesus says to him, "Jonah, my friend, I have come to take you away. You, my Lord, I'm dying, but I'm happy to have you here. My faithful friend," Jesus says, "you are now free, and you will not die here. I am taking you to my house." "Free? Why? To your house? Oh, yes, you did promise me that I would see your mother." Jesus is most loving, bending over the miserable bed of the unhappy man, and Jonah seems to be recovering on account of his joy. "Peter, you are strong. Lift up Jonah, and you, give your mantles. This bed is too hard for one in this state." The disciples take off their mantles at once. They fold them several times, lay them on the mat, using some as pillow. Peter lays down his load of bones, and Jesus covers him with his own mantle. "Peter, have you got any money?" "Yes, Master. I have 40 coins." "Good, let us go. Cheer up, Jonah. A little more trouble, and then there will be so much peace in my house near Mary. And Jonah says, Mary, yes, oh, your house. In his extreme weakness, poor Jonah weeps. He can but weep. Goodbye, woman. The Lord will bless you for your mercy. Goodbye, Lord. Goodbye, Jonah. Pray for me. The young woman is weeping. She was taking care of the old man. So Jesus pretends, as he leaves, Doris appears in the doorway and insists that Jesus not take the bed. He says, I sold you the servant. The bed is mine. And Jesus merely throws a purse at his feet without saying a word. Doris finds 40 coins and 5 didrachmas and complains that it's too little. Jesus stares at the greedy, revolting torturer without saying a word. Doris now tries to persuade Jesus to withdraw his curse, but Jesus only gives him a crushing glare. I entrust you to the God of Sinai. When Doris sees that it's useless to try any further, he shows his true colors, and he shouts. It's on page 586. I thought I had marked this, but I have to find it. Yes, he says, and he shouts, we will meet again, Jesus. I will have you in my clutches again. I will fight you to the death. You can take that worn-out man. I no longer need him. I will save his burial money. Go away, cursed Satan. I will set the whole Sanhedrin on you. Satan. Jesus pretends that he does not hear. The disciples are dismayed. Jesus attends only to Jonah, and he looks after the men as they walk along the path. And here we again pick up where we left off. As they enter the road, he managed to secure help from Roman soldiers who are passing by in a wagon. They agree to carry Jonah and the company's, the disciples, and they offer Jonah wine, honey, and butter from their supplies. They have deep respect for Rabbi Jesus of Nazareth. While they're on the way, Jesus teaches them about the true God as opposed to their false gods. He also speaks of the eternal happiness in heaven, that they have a soul that will live forever with God if they live a good life. They're pleased with the teaching and promise to come to Caesarea to hear Jesus preach. As the company approaches Nazareth, John runs ahead to inform Mary, who is already waiting for them at the doorway. There's a loving exchange between Jesus and Mary and Jonah, as Jesus reminds Jonah about the year of his birth in Bethlehem. And Jesus takes Jonah into the little room where St. Joseph died. And on page 588, we pick up the scene. And he says here to Jonah, you are in my father's bed, meaning St. Joseph, and here is my mother, and I'm here. See, Nazareth becomes Bethlehem, and you are now the little Jesus between two people who love you. And these are the ones who venerate you as the faithful servant. You cannot see the angels, but they are waving their bright wings above you and are singing the words of the Christmas psalm. Jesus pours all his kindness on poor Jonah, who is getting worse from one second to the next. He seems to have resisted so far to die here, but he's happy. He smiles, tries to kiss Jesus' hand and Mary's, and to say, but his anguish interrupts his words. Mary comforts him like a mother, and he repeats, yes, yes, with a blissful smile on his emaciated face. So the disciples are standing at the kitchen entrance silently watching the scene with deep emotion. And Jesus continues with most loving words of comfort. And here we pick up on that. And he says, God has listened to your long desire, Jonah. The star of your long night is now becoming the star of your eternal morning. You know its name, says Jesus. And he says, Jesus, yours. O Jesus, the angels, who will sing the angelic hymn for me? My soul can hear it, but also my ears wish to hear it. Who? To make me sleep happy. I am so sleepy. So much work I have done, so many tears, so many insults. Doris, I forgive him. But I do not want to hear his voice, and I hear it. It is like the voice of Satan near me, who am dying. Who will cover that voice for me with the words that came from heaven? And it's Mary, our Blessed Lady, who on the same tune as her lullaby sings softly, Glory to God in the highest heaven, and peace to men down here. And she repeats it two or three times because she sees that Jonah calms down on hearing it. And so Jonah says a few words in remembrance of the birth of Jesus. And after these words, he breathed a short breath, and there's silence. And Jesus says, we shall bury him in our poor sepulcher near the tomb of Joseph. What a beautiful way to die, with Jesus and Mary beside him. So the next chapter, Jesus in the house of Jacob near Lake Merom. And this is on page 589. He's walking with his disciples along the shore of Lake Merom on a much-traveled road. It's a rather dull day, and Peter is complaining about having to take his route that takes him away from Jerusalem, where they hope to be in time for the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus corrects him and says that they obeyed God in doing the good deed for the woman whose son was dying, that's the paralytic we heard about, than going to some external ceremonies in the temple. The disciples talk about the happy death of Jonah, but pity his poor life burden with so much suffering. And at this point, Simon Zealot is sad over not having been able to help this poor man when he was alive. And Jesus answers him and his sadness. It's in the middle of page 590. He said, it doesn't matter, Simon. He is happier now and more active. And you have done more than anyone would have done for him and for me. I thank you also on his behalf. He now knows who freed him. Namely, remember, he bought his freedom with his money. And he blesses you. Well, then, he curses Doris, too, exclaims Peter. Jesus looks at him and says, do you think so? You are mistaken. Jonah was a just man. Now he's a saint. He did not hate or curse when he was alive. He does not hate or curse now. From his place of expectation, he's looking at paradise. And as he already knows, that limbo will soon let the expectant one out. He's jubilant. He does nothing else. Now there's the Lord's view on limbo. So Peter now asks whether Doris will be struck by Jesus' anathema. And Jesus says, I have entrusted him to the justice of God. I, the love, have abandoned him. The disciples also all say that they would not like to be in his shoes now. The disciples wonder what justice of God would be like. And Jesus answered, it would be like an ecstasy for the good. It will be like a thunderbolt for the Satans. My friends, I solemnly tell you, to be for a whole life a slave, a leper, a beggar, is regal happiness as compared to 1 hour, one single hour of divine punishment. It now begins to rain and they look for shelter. They meet a woman who is driving 8 sheep in front of her. She takes him to the house of her master. The owner is repairing a broken plowshare, and he invites Jesus and the disciples to come into his house. He's had a poor harvest due to blight, hail, grubs, diseased plants, and herds. He has food only for one person, but a good fire. And he says that he heard Jesus speak at the house of Judas and Anna during the vintage time. And after sharing all his troubles, Jesus says that they are inconveniencing the poor man, who denies that it's a bother to him. And Jesus now offers to mend the plowshare. and he amazes the poor man by his skill. The plow is now good enough for another year, and then there will be time to get a new one. Jesus compliments the farmer for his kindness and mercy, and he says, "You do not foster ill feeling of selfishness and envy, but you accept my doctrine and you practice it. Blessed be the merciful, they will receive mercy." The poor farmer now says that he regrets more than ever being so poor because he cannot provide for Jesus and the disciples. All he has is goodwill. And on page 593, we have the response here. Jesus says, "Your goodwill is enough for me. I solemnly tell you, also a cup of water given in my name is a great thing in the eyes of God. I was a tired wayfarer caught in a storm, and you've given me hospitality. Mealtime comes, and you say to me, 'I offer you what I have.' Night falls, and you offer me a friendly roof. What more do you want me to do? Be confident, Jacob. The Son of Man does not look at the pomp of reception or food, but he looks at the feelings of one's heart. The Son of God says to the Father, 'Father, bless my benefactors and all those who in my name are merciful to their brothers.' That is what I'm saying for you." So Jesus now blesses the food, breaks the bread, and hands it out. Now in the next chapter, they return to Jordan, and they're near Jericho. Jesus and the disciples are on the eastern bank of the Jordan. They're surprised that the Baptist is not there, because that's where normally he has his ministry. They decide to cross the Jordan and ask the ferryman about the Baptist, who tells them that he's gone to the border of Samaria to seek safety from his enemies. As they talk, the ferryman became aware that Jesus is more than an ordinary man. When Jesus compliments him about his wisdom in judging and adds, "I tell you that not only Abraham, but the God of Abraham will smile at you as at a faithful son when you die." The ferryman then says on page 594, he says, "Oh God, is it true that who are you? "I'm a just man," Jesus says. "Listen, I told you that there are two in Israel. One is the Baptist and the other the Messiah. Are you the Messiah?" "Yes, I am." "Oh, eternal mercy. But one day I heard some Pharisees say," "Never mind. I do not want to foul my mouth. You are not what they said. Their tongues are forked like vipers." "Yes," Jesus says, "I am. And I say to you, you are not very far from the light. Goodbye, Solomon. Peace be with you." When Jesus tells him that he's going to Jerusalem, he's surprised that even the Messiah has to go to observe the feasts. And Jesus says, "I am the son of the law, too. I do not repeal the law. I give it light and strength so that it may be fulfilled in a perfect way." The ferryman is aware that Jerusalem already hates Jesus, meaning the Pharisees, and cautions Jesus. And Jesus says, "Leave them alone. They do their duty, what they think is their duty," means in their warped minds. "I do mine. I solemnly tell you that until the hour comes, they will not be able to do anything." And in 595, middle of the page, we have that response. And to that he says, "Which hour, Lord?" asked the disciples and the ferryman. Jesus says, "The hour of the triumph of darkness," meaning Good Friday. "Will you live until the end of the world?" "No," Jesus says. "There will be a more dreadful darkness than the darkness of the extinguished stars and of our planets, dead with all its inhabitants. And it will take place when men extinguish the light, which is I," meaning in death. "The crime has already been committed by many." "Goodbye, Solomon." He means they're already planning his death. The disciples become fearful, and Jesus reassures them, "Do not be afraid for me or for yourselves. meaning we are not harmed. He speaks of the need for much labor and suffering. There will be much opposition, but there will be many who will become disciples. When the disciples say that they are so few against so many enemies, again Jesus replies, he says, "My friends, remember the dream of Jacob. He saw," this is page 596, "he saw an incalculable multitude of angels descending, ascending, and descending a ladder that from heaven reached down to the patriarch. A multitude, and yet it was but a part of the angelical cohorts." Well, if even all the cohorts that sing hallelujah to God in heaven should come down to defend me, when the hour comes, he means of his death, they will be of no avail. Justice is to be fulfilled. In other words, evil will seemingly prevail. And now only one of them understands what Jesus is trying to say, and that's Simon Zealot, to whom Jesus says, "You've understood, Simon." And he says, "I have, Lord, I've understood." Now Peter takes Simon aside, and he asks for an explanation. And then he tells Peter that Jesus' enemies will cause him much suffering and surround him like a pack of wild dogs. He prays that the disciples will not desert Jesus at that time. He even foretells they, while they have courage now because of Jesus' presence, they will find their courage melt away under the fierce attack of Satan and these Satans, meaning the devils. He adds, "After the vile necessary test, faith and love will unite us firmly again, and we will be like crystal proof against cuts." Peter looks at Jesus with much love and concern. He says, "Master, Master, smile. I don't like to see you so sad. You are as dear to me as a son. Forgive me if I said to you, son." "It's because I love you, Jesus." And Jesus responds, "I'm no longer sad. See, I'm smiling because you are friendly to me." And then finally the chapter, Jesus in the house of Lazarus, and Martha speaks of the Magdalene. It's a market square in Jericho. Zacchaeus, the tax collector, is plying his legal and illegal extortions. He also deals in jewelry and valuables. A slender young woman, completely dressed in a huge, rusty gray mantle, approaches. Her face is covered with a veil. She takes a gold bracelet and hands it over to Zacchaeus, and takes the money without any word, walks away. Behind her is Judas Iscariot, watching intently. He tries to speak to her, but she hastens away. Judas doesn't give up. He asks everyone in sight, and they make fun of him, because they seem to know what he wants, while Judas feigns contempt for her. One man says, "By the looks of your face, I can hardly believe it," namely, that he's not craving for a woman. While Judas is running away from two men who are laughing at him, he suddenly runs into Jesus and the disciples. He's surprised, and so are the disciples. And Jesus says only, "You are here?" Judas mumbles something, but Peter breaks in to a loud laugh. He remembers Judas having said that he was going to carry it to help with the vintage. And Peter says, remind Judas about this saying, "There are no vineyards here." And I cannot believe that Judas, in all this dust, can gather grapes simply because he's a disciple of the rabbi. He's taunting him. Here in the dialogue, we have the deceitfulness of Judas. And Judas says here on page 600, he said, "Vintage is finished a long time ago," Judas replies harshly. And Peter says, "And carrieth is many miles away." "You are attacking me at once. You're hostile to me." Peter, "No, I'm not such a fool as you think." "That's enough," commands Jesus. He's severe. He addresses Judas, "I was not expecting to see you here. I thought you would be in Jerusalem for the tabernacles." "I am going there tomorrow. I've been waiting here for a friend of our family who..." "Please," Jesus says, "that's enough." Do you not believe me, Master? I swear I did not ask you anything. And please do not say anything. You are here, that's enough. Are you thinking of coming with us, or have you still got business to attend to? Answer frankly. No, I finished. In any case, that fellow is not coming, and I'm going to Jerusalem for the feast. And where are you going? Jesus says, to Jerusalem. Today, I will be at Bethany this evening, Jesus says. At Lazarus' house? Yes, at Lazarus. Well, I will come too. Yes, come as far as Bethany. Then Andrew with James of Zebedee and Thomas will go to Gethsemane to make preparations and wait for us all, and he emphasizes, and you will go with them. Jesus stresses the last word in such a way that Judas doesn't react. And what about us, Peter asks. And then Jesus gives instructions there for that. The rest of the disciples go with Jesus to Bethany to prepare the people for Jesus' teaching. And once they're in Bethany, Jesus divides the group and sends them to their respective destination. But Judas tries to stay at Lazarus' house. He doesn't give up. But Jesus sees through his excuses for delaying and sends him off without delay. Meantime, Peter is watching this, and he says, he was hoping there might be a change in the instructions. And Jesus says, never, Peter. I know what I'm doing, but bear with that man, Peter. And Peter says, I will try, but I cannot promise. And he leaves with Matthew. Only John, Simon, Peter, or Philip, and Bartholomew remain with Jesus in the house. All through these years is Peter and Judas. And Peter sees through the sham. See? Now Martha enters the scene on page 601. She's a swarthy, tall, although not quite as tall as her sister, that's Mary Magdalene, who is fair-haired and rosy. But she's a beautiful young woman with a balanced and well-shaped plump body, a little dark head, smooth brown forehead. Her eyes are kind, mild, dark, long shape, and as soft as velvet between her dark eyelashes. Her nose is slightly turned down, and her small lips are very red against her dark cheeks. She smiles, showing strong, snow-white teeth. Now, Lazarus enters here with Jesus, and he enters, introduces her to Jesus with these words, Martha here is good and pious. She's the consolation and the honor of the family and the joy of poor Lazarus. Before she was my first and only joy. Now she's the second because you, Jesus, are the first. Lazarus inquires about the poor shepherd Jonah. Jesus tells him that he died a free man and happy in his home at Nazareth. They talk about Doris and his cruelty, and Lazarus said, he's a devil and hates you. That hyena hates the whole world. Did he not tell you that he hates you? Yes, Jesus said, he did. Lazarus is distressed that Doris might want to take Jesus away from him. But Jesus comforts him with these words, page 602. I am the solace of those who are tormented and the companion of those who are forlorn. I have come to you also for that. Ah, then you know. Oh, shame on me, Lazarus says. No, why on you? I know. So what? Shall I anathematize you, everybody? And what shall I be for those who are innocent? The sin for which you suffer is not yours, he means the Magdalene, his sister. Shall I be pitiless towards you if I feel pity also for her? And Lazarus says, have you seen her? And Jesus says, I have. Don't cry. But Lazarus' head is resting on his folded arms on a table, and he's weeping, sobbing painfully. The conversation there referred to Mary Magdalene, and Lazarus is very sad. Martha asks how Lazarus came to know about Jesus' knowledge. and she tells him that Judas Iscariot told him that Jesus saw her on the lake with lovers that we took last month. Remember, they were in the boats, and the leisure boats passed in front of them, Mary Magdalene in one of the boats. And then she says, "Pray for her, Master. I pray, but I cannot forgive completely. And perhaps the Eternal Father rejects my prayer." But Jesus says, "You are right. You must forgive to be forgiving, forgiven, and heard. Give me your full, holy forgiveness, and I will pray." So Martha says, on page 603, "Forgive, we will not be able. Our mother died of grief through her ill deeds, and they were still slight compared with the present ones. I see my mother's torture. It is always present to me, and I see what Lazarus is suffering." And Jesus said, "She is ill, Martha, and insane. Forgive her." Martha says, "She's possessed, Master." And what is diabolical possession? Jesus says, "But a disease of the spirit infected by Satan to the extent of degenerating into a spiritual diabolical being. How can certain perversions in human beings be explained otherwise? Perversions that make man much worse than beasts in ferocity, more lewd than monkeys in lust, and so on, and make a hybrid in which man, animal, and demon are mingled." That is the explanation of what amazes us as an inexplicable monstrosity in so many creatures. "Do not weep. Forgive. I see because my sight is sharper than the sight of the eye or of the heart. I see God. I see, I tell you. Forgive because she is ill." Then Martha says, "Cure her then." And Jesus says, "I will cure her. Have faith. I will make you happy. But forgive. Tell Lazarus to forgive. Forgive her. Love her. Be on familiar terms with her." Notice that. That's when you have a live-in son wants to come home with his live-in wife, and you don't know what to do. You won't have him sleep in the house, but he can come home. "Speak to her as if she were like you. Speak to her of me." So Jesus encourages Martha to speak to the Magdalene of him. And he says, "My name, even by itself, is salvation. Get her to think of me and to mention my name." And he says this now, "Satan runs away when a heart thinks of my name, Jesus." Hold on to that. Satan runs away when a heart thinks of my name, Jesus. Tears and sorrow now, and later joy and glory. Go. Tell Lazarus, while I, in the peace of your garden, will pray the Father for Mary and for you. Amen.
That last paragraph is...
Oh, there are many beautiful insights here.
Yes.
Well, we have much more time. Time for discussion. Time for what else? Any questions?
Was Jesus so kind to Judas all along because he wanted to see Judas saved? Why was he so good to him? When he saw right through him.
Because no, see, God extends mercy in this life until the final moment.
Yes.
This is what he does to all of us. Then the time for justice is after death. He wants everyone to be saved so that no one, a Hitler, a Mussolini, a Stalin, whatever, could say, "You didn't help me, didn't give me a chance." No soul can point to God and say, "You are not merciful." See? And later on, as you read through the other volumes, he suffered in a cave all night praying for Judas. And he said, "Father, if there has to be a traitor, let it not be my friend. Let it not be my friend, Judas." See? Up to the last moment, he was praying that in some other way it would be done. See, the way this is done is masterful. This woman could never have put all this together. What you have is the mind of God at work in all this. And how people could say that this is a sentimentalized novel, they are very unfair, unjust.
What is the latest on the reading of the book? Lil, I've been going through this process.
She came late when you told her.
I came late. There was traffic on the road. I'm sorry.
Don't you know about Cardinal Ratzinger? He wrote a letter to an editor in Birmingham on this question. And he said, it may be published. It may be printed.
Okay?
Which means he couldn't do that if there was something wrong with teaching. So he could not give that permission. But he himself did not read it. And he says, no. He says, he bases it on the Vatican newspaper about 20 years ago. And he says, it can't be considered supernatural. Here where we disagree. The theologians of outstanding reputation say it is. Besides, it's private revelation, so you have your freedom to accept it or not. You don't commit a sin, and you cannot give it divine faith anyhow. It's private revelation. We only give this to Scripture. But to disregard it in the face of approval like Pius XII, we go all the way back to that. He said, publish this as it is when he read it. But all these men, including Cardinal Ratzinger, did not read it. Whatever, but to make a judgment like that without real substantiation is not fair.
I think it's terrific the way the book is there, and you take and make notes so simplified for us to understand it.
Well, this is what I've told the people in Florida. I've asked, how should I present it? And they said, just the way you're doing it. If you have any other suggestion, why, let me know.
You improve, because when you did it at the beginning, you read too much. Now you're doing,
this is much better.
I'm trying to intersperse that with comments and developing the thought and so forth, okay?
You bring the gospel teaching in.
Yes.
You know, like where you can find it.
Right. If people don't have the book and they haven't read it, they may find a problem with this. But I challenge anyone that is listening to me now, has never read it, before you make a judgment, read the book.
Yeah.
Don't be like these men who read 10 pages and they say, this is for the birds. This lady's insane. That is injustice. It's a sin to say that when they're judging a person without having read the book and allowing them to get really involved in seeing what the book is about. That was my first reaction, too. It was unfair, though. I saw two books like this and I said, these books, each of them as big as the Bible. How could she have given all this? But when I started to read it, with all my own background in theology and so forth, I said, this woman, bedridden for 28 years, where could she do the research? And scholars are amazed in their own sciences that she knew so much about insect life, plant life, astronomy, the history of the Jewish people, the culture, theology. It's amazing. And Gabriel Rossini, world's foremost Mariologist, wrote 125 books on Mary, a lifetime. When he read these works, he said, my goodness, all that I've read or studied cannot equal what I found in these books on Mary. And he spent a whole year presenting that in lectures at the university in Rome. And the book was published. And it was congratulated by Paul VI. There's an authority. Don't you see there's confusion over this? There's where Satan is at his best. See? Not yet.
No.
Not yet. But they don't compare.
No, they don't.
There are fewer books, and these are more detailed. They're more authentic. The most authentic, I think, that I've ever read of private revelation.
It's a real spiritual journey, you know?
Yeah, these books are gems.
You're almost through the first volume. The second volume, when would you be starting the second volume book?
In 1999. No, we'll have it done by June of next year, even earlier, because I've got maybe about 200 pages to go, and we're doing 50 pages at a time. But I'd rather do it that way. It doesn't matter how much, but people are trying to get the whole set now. including John Hafford from the Blue Army. He has asked for them, and he's found them very informative, and he's told me so. I know he's going to hear this on this tape. John, I hope you'll laugh when you hear this. any other question? Well, anything on the topic? Anything on the topic that we've had? Yes, Jean.
With the two Marys, Mary,
Mary of Alphaeus, Mary of Clophis, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus.
But I don't know. For some reason or other, I don't think of Mary, the sister of Lazarus, as Mary Magdalene.
Well, that's true in the gospel. That's been a debate among scholars, whether the two were different or sisters.
Yeah.
It's all settled here, and it makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense.